7 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Spring Motorcycle Swap Meet, Sunday, June 11th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Milwaukee Elks Lodge in Oak Grove. The Spring Motorcycle Swap Meet is hosted by Abate of Oregon, a group that promotes motorcycle awareness, education, safety, and liberty through community involvement and legislative action. Again, that's the Spring Motorcycle Swap Meet, hosted by Abate of Oregon, on Sunday, June 11th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. The outdoor swap meet is at the Milwaukee Elks Lodge, 13122 Southeast McLaughlin Boulevard in Oak Grove. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 44 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
At the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs on the KBOO airwaves since 1978, the longest-running feminist radio broadcast program in the country. Bread and Roses is a collective of women and non-binary radio activists who give voice to those in global and local spaces, working for social justice and equity, and we strive to challenge systems of oppression. All this, and we have fun. We want our bread and roses too, get it? I'm your host tonight, Pamela Santos. Our engineer is Tom Flynn. So we've been doing this segment that we've been calling Doing Things, where we talk to folks, women and gender nonconforming folks, about, well, doing things, whatever it is. This is a 1 hour installment of Doing Things, where I talk to Malika Balaj about self-care, yes, the NBA Finals, love of basketball, authenticity, and food, whether it's for the body or for the spirit. And this is really the time that I think I've been needing to have some food for the spirit. I don't know about you, but definitely what's been going on here in Portland is a lot of healing. There's been violence that has changed our city. Really, it's forever changed it. But a lot of what marginalized communities in Portland have already been feeling is there has always been violence and trauma. And a lot of what happened 2 weeks ago on the Max had uncovered that for people who hadn't been aware, hadn't been looking at that, hadn't been feeling that before. And it's just been hard for, whether it's been communities of color, allies who are struggling to know what to do, and really just the public at large having to face a lot of this without a lot of maybe the skills or just even the practice in dealing with difficult situations. And this is where I'm hoping to provide, maybe it could be respite, maybe it could be some release by being able to talk about things. But in a lot of ways, it's something that can be relevant for any time, because we all need to understand how to take care of ourselves at any time, whether that's now, whether that's in the future, whether that's been for however our ancestors have done that before. And this is why it's been such a pleasure and an honor to talk to Malika Balaj, who is a Moroccan-American writer and youth educator here in Portland. Her work explores the dynamics of authenticity, tradition, and identity. She wrote and designed Binti, Daughter of Arab America, in 2016, and is currently one half of Ya Banat, a storytelling project reframing narratives of the North African diaspora. In February, Malika offered Atai and Stories of Home alongside Andrea Telles and Blanca S. Villalobos of Pochas Radicales at IPRC for Stacey Tran's series, Tender Table. If you hadn't heard of this food storytelling event, please look them up. They're on tendertable.tumblr.com. Malika offers pop-up dinners that provide space for artists and community to connect and build. And this is where we start off. Her free time, she plays basketball, but I really think that is quite an understatement. She loves basketball. I hope you can take something from the following conversation, and I'm still actually really meditating on a lot of the things that we talked about. What name did you think you wanted to change your name to when you were a kid?
When I was a kid, people actually called me Molly for many years. So my given name was Malika, but people called me Molly. And for some reason, Molly always felt like it fit, like I was a Molly. You know how people tell you, oh, you're such a Molly. But I knew at some point I wanted to be called Malika, and so, which is my given name. And so because people would always ask me, are you Irish? And I'm like, nah. So when I moved, when I was around 17 and I lived in Spain, no one could pronounce Molly. So I went back to Malika, and my only wish was that it be spelled with an A, because it's spelled with an E, which isn't really not that important, but I mean, it's a dialect. It's how we pronounce it versus how other people pronounce it. Some people in Morocco, it's all phonetic, you know, it doesn't matter. It's the same name. And it means queen, so.
Well. We met at Tender Table, mm-hmm. right? And I would say that was about February or so. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get to really hang out and talk with you, even though we had like all of these things in common we wanted to talk about. But the best thing in common that I recently discovered, and we got to fulfill this, is being sports heads together. And I'm also going to take myself out of that and say, like, you are clearly the queen of sports heads at this point right now, because I am still an aspiring.
Yeah, I mean, I love sports. You know, I grew up hooping in my neighborhood with my brother and his friends and everybody in the neighborhood, and played for a long time. And so the game I always understood. And then my mama, she loves football. My father loves soccer and tennis. And so sports was just kind of a thing that brought us together, kind of in the community, both out in the neighborhood, but also in our home. And I stopped playing basketball when I got into high school for a lot of reasons, but still always loved the game and always understood it. So yeah, I mean, I love sports. I love sports so much. I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, so that's where the University of Michigan is. So this is a big, this is a big sports town. You know, growing up in Ann Arbor, everybody, you know, knows about University of Michigan football. It's the biggest stadium in the country. I grew up just a stone's throw away from the stadium and from Chrysler Arena, where the basketball players play. So a lot of big names that came out of that school. So it's kind of just embedded into the culture of the space. And then just neighborhoods, you know, you just always play in sports.
Is it the kind of place where, like, kids would go along with everybody to all different kinds of games?
Sometimes. I mean, I think accessibility is definitely an issue around that. We didn't really go to the games often. I used to go with my Uncle Muhammad. He had season tickets, and I would sit with him. You know, he's so tall. I mean, I was tiny. I was a tiny kid. And I used to just sit up with him on the bleachers and watch games, you know, with him every once in a while. But mostly we just watch from home. And then I played in Chrysler Arena once, which is like my, you know, that was the years that I wanted to be in the WNBA. And I was just dreaming big.
How young were you?
I was in middle school, junior high.
But when you dreamed of the WNBA?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a professional ball player.
And was it something that other people encouraged you to?
Yeah, I mean, people knew I could hoop, so they were like, you should keep playing. But I got caught up in some other things, unfortunately, and so I wasn't able to continue doing that. And, you know, it is what it is. Some days I sigh and I'm like, oh, man, I wish I could have done that. But I still play all the time. It's just not to the same caliber that it could have been.
Now, I have to ask, because no one can see how you look or appear or anything. How tall are you?
I'm 5'6".
So what was your, like, specialty? Like, what was the thing you're really known for?
Well, I loved AI when I was growing up, Allen Iverson, and that was my number 3. I loved how, like, vivacious he was and how intense of a player he was, and I loved his crossover. So that was what I used to just sneak around people. I was really small. I was really skinny for many years. I didn't develop until I was in, like, you know, junior or senior in high school, so much later. And so I could just sneak in between people. I have really, I have a lot of skills, you know, in terms of those things.
I basically asked, how do you ball, but not.
Yeah. I mean, cool I way. Like to, you know, I was a point guard. So I really focused on, like, moving the ball and setting up plays and assisting people, which is kind of part of my personality. So it's interesting how that crossed over, you know. But I always had handles. I could always move the ball really well by myself and with other people. And that's part of the dance of the game that's so beautiful. Yeah.
There's that. What I loved about watching the games with you, so we only watched one NBA Finals game, but that you had this really good sense of, this is what's happening based on when you're kind of on the court, this is what your eyes are seeing, and you have to do this. And it seems like, honestly, if a team is not keeping the ball in their hands, then yeah, you can't do anything else. You can't score, you can't do anything.
Yeah, you got to control the ball. I mean, and people do that obviously in very different ways, and teams have different strategies around how they maintain that. But yeah, I mean, if you don't have the ball, you're not going to progress. Although I always personally was more interested in defense, because I think defensive style can interrupt offense, and you have a lot of strength in that power, and then you can progress your offense depending on how strong your defensive style is. So that was always where I loved to play more. To just kind of get in people's heads and really follow them and be really patient. But there's definitely a lexicon to sports, and knowing kind of how to talk ball is, I think, just something that you learn when you play and watch a lot.
Do you think that you played ball differently in a team versus when you're just having fun?
I'm so competitive. Like, I don't play.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I don't play with a team right now. Sometimes I play with my students, but a lot of times I don't actually have the time to do that. But, you know, right now I just hoop by myself a lot. It's very meditative for me. Sometimes I'll just shoot free throws for hours. Not necessarily hours, maybe like a half an hour or an hour up at Mount Tabor. It's just very meditative, and it takes a lot of patience and a lot of focus and a lot of precision. And that's really good for my mind. And then I'll just run back and forth and do layups like I did when I was a kid, you know, because that's good for my heart and move around in the trees, on the court. But I don't play with a team right now. I would love to. And I hope to do that soon indoor, because indoor is really different than outdoor ball.
And even when you were like in childhood, but also now too, is there something, I want to call it like lessons off the court that you took mm-hmm. from it?
Oh, so much. I mean, patience, I think, is a really big one. Learning how to be patient with yourself as you're learning. Team, you know, obviously teamwork and working with other people who have different styles and different kind of complexes around how the ball should move and around how excuse me, the game should be played. I think that, like, for as competitive as I am, learning how to lose is really important. And in terms of that, you know, learning how to lose and also being appreciative and honoring people who win, that's very hard for me in sports. I'm really good at the outside of that medium, but I can tend to get kind of defensive. So I think it's a good skill to learn and something that you can learn playing sports. That's just brings people together.
And when we were talking, you told me who your favorite player was. Not Allen Iverson at the time. Like, it was someone who flashed.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Yeah. Yes. Lew Alcindor. Yeah, that's my favorite player because, I mean, not only was he a master with the ball, but, I mean, this man, like, he was a Muslim, you know, and he converted while he was in the league. And it was a really big deal at the time for him to do that. And he was very outspoken. And also kind of didn't really engage with the press and still kind of has that, is seen as kind of aloof, which I think is a shame because I think that he is just kind of choosing when and where he wants to share his knowledge. And I have a lot of respect for him. There have been, you know, a lot of players in the league that have struggled for being Muslim, for their names. You know, it's, again, people didn't want to stop calling him Lew Alcindor, you know? They didn't want to call him Kareem, even though that was a name that he chose when he converted. I have a lot of respect for the man both on and off the court. And I think that that's important because there are other players that on the court, they're great, but out in the world maybe don't, you know, do as much as I think a person like him does just for himself, his community, his identity, his religion, his spirituality, how he walks through the world.
Even to this day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I love when, you know, he writes an article from the Washington Post or my mama will send it to me in a text before I'll even see it.
Who knew that I was going to, on this Bread and Roses show, be able to reference Charlemagne right now? But yeah, he did follow up in one of his, where he was the guest this time, just referencing that it was a shame at the time when Kaepernick still wasn't signed, that he was being penalized for using sports as a platform, as people should, that sports can be a platform. And why mm-hmm. wouldn't you mm-hmm. make it a platform that is not only just for, and this is not his words, but you know, just bowing your head and just playing the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's being punished because he's black and has an opinion that opposes the franchise that he is being paid multi-millions by. I mean, I think it's that simple. I mean, I think it's extremely complicated. And I think that it really comes down to like this deep systemic racism, the sickness that we have in this country and in places that have been colonized by Western Europe. I have a lot of respect for him, a lot.
If you, I don't want to play the what if game, but yes, if you had made it into the WNBA and you saw in the headlines around the same time last year mm-hmm. that certain players were also getting penalized in some way for wearing Black Lives Matter shirts.
Mm-hmm. I think they were I Can't Breathe shirts.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it was in Minnesota. It was the WNBA team there.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. That they were told to wear the branded shirts mm-hmm. that they had. And do you think that, you know, as a Muslim, you would have taken that stance as well in all, you know, in just in political forms of protest?
Oh, absolutely. I have no question. I mean, as a Muslim, like, I don't believe in materialism or consumerism. And that's how I was raised in my tradition. And, you know, just like in Christianity or any other, you know, large faith, there's going to be differences in how people understand and identify within the complex of their religion. But for me, I was raised in a way that, you know, materialism and consumerism is not as important to me as many other things. And with that said, you know, I think that making that type of statement and losing the financial, because they lost money when they did that. And to me, I think that that's worth it. I mean, I don't even think it's a question. It's not a question in my mind whether or not I would have done it. Of course I would have done it, because young people look to those of us who are young adults, elders, for signs. How do we live in the world? How do we navigate the world? How do we be here in a good way? And I think that when you have that kind of a platform, it's our responsibility. For me, if I was in that position, absolutely, I would have done that. And it would be worth the money, because in the end of the day, the money isn't as important as laying, you know, the groundwork for the future generation to, you know, have it easier.
I'm going to unpack a little bit more, even though I wasn't even specific the first time around. When it came down to the WNBA kind of taking the stance, I still saw it as, you have to look at all the aspects that it's still different from Colin Kaepernick's protest and other people who have taken on Colin Kaepernick's protest, because the WNBA is still not in the same way valued as NBA players. That contracts for WNBA players, but also sponsorships, that's the big thing. I mean, this is where we're at with Serena Williams and her amazing deals that she's able to make from being the best in her form, best in her sport, best in sports, and yet still not making as much as the white woman that she continually keeps beating.
Yeah, I mean, what more is there to say? You know, like, yeah, I agree with you in everything you just said. And I think that I don't know a lot about the politics of the WNBA and about, you know, sponsorship. And I mean, I do think that there's a lot related here to, you know, patriarchy and misogyny, as they are sicknesses in our contemporary culture and have been, you know, since its inception. So these are just reflections of that. And I think, you know, that choice to make that statement is so powerful. And two, it is almost as powerful as the media lets it be. You know, Colin Kaepernick has gotten a lot of press, which is great. The WNBA, what the women did in Minnesota, I haven't seen nearly as much press for that, which kind of just, it echoes the same, like, amount of you know, support that there is for the WNBA, maybe beside the NBA, for example. I mean, for God's sake, the commercials for the WNBA have NBA players saying, this is why I watch the WNBA, this is my favorite player. So it's almost like we need as a society to see, you know, a man validate why, like, women hooping is okay. So it's a much bigger issue than we could even, like, unpack today, you know? But I'm just glad that it's happening all around, because it's for all of our benefit, because it's for the healing of our people as we live in community with each other. And, yeah, I just honor Colin Kaepernick and these women and everyone that's done that, you know, for their Muhammad Ali, you know, for their service.
Who knew that I was going to, on this Bread and Roses show, be able to reference Charlemagne right now? But yeah, he did follow up in one of his, where he was the guest this time, just referencing that it was a shame at the time when Kaepernick still wasn't signed, that he was being penalized for using sports as a platform, as people should, that sports can be a platform. When we were watching the game, I'm going to set the scene a little bit. It was, for those not knowing what was going on in Portland at the time, it was on the Sunday where there were counter protests organized to counter the planned, there's no other way I would describe it, as white nationalists coming to Portland. And there was a lot of fear with knowing whether people were going to go to the counter protests, who was laying their bodies on the line in danger, on the front lines, what was going to happen potentially with police responses on that day, but also in Chapman Square, what actually happened as it unfolded in live video and real-time updates. So when we're sitting down and trying to have this, okay, I considered it as, yes, we are two people, but we were sitting down in community when we were going to go watch game two. And yet, it was never far from either of us to be able to think about and talk about where other people were at that time and earlier in the day. So I'm just kind of setting the scene for that, because I think I really do want to bring up why you and I, as people of color in this particular city, rocked by that particular attack a week earlier, and all of these other pretty much like a brush fire, you know, just catching a flame everywhere, why it was still important for us to sit down and bring food and cook for each other and watch this.
Yeah, I think that that was so healing for me.
Yes.
Mashallah.
For me too.
That was like, I thought as I was driving home, I was like, that's exactly where I needed to be today. You know, because I moved away from my family when I was 17 years old. And I've made some decisions when to have people in my life that haven't served me well. And now when I look around in my community, I'm like, I just feel grateful and I feel blessed. And to just get to sit in your space, you know, with your son and like eating your beautiful food and getting to share a soup that we make during Ramadan, even though I'm not able to fast because I'm not in good enough health to fast this year, you know, to be able to share those things and to watch a game, you know, and talk about it and sit on the couch. I mean, it was just such... I think that those moments can be like so sacred as we move through this world where we find community in our food, in our traditions, in, you know, getting to know each other. I mean, you brought down these cookbooks that were these beautiful cookbooks. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, here's another person that gets cookbooks from the library. You feel me? I think that...
Continually renewing.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that that, like, there's a reason why that happens. There's a bigger spiritual thing happening here. You feel me? And I think that we don't always know how that is going to play out and how it played out in that moment as this really violent and haunting thing is happening not very far from us. But we were in that space together, taking care of each other. I mean, I think that that's beautiful. And I hope that the people, you know, other people who I love that chose to not go down there felt that similar sense of ceremony with whoever they chose to be with that day.
There was a lot of intention, not just for you and me, but I think for a lot of, I still consider it in a lot of ways one community for us in Portland, not just knowing the same people, but we're in the same city. And people made a lot of choices about where they were going to be, how they were going to support,
how they were going to take care of themselves. And I still think that it's an ongoing process to figure that out for yourself. And I mean, this was one way, and I definitely know that we're going to be talking about the other ways too, including food, like how self-care is still a form of, it's part of a resistance. It's still part of someone's activism.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering a lot right now about, like, what does self-care mean? Because there are these words in English that they encompass so much. Like, community is a great one. You know, self-care. What does it mean for me? What does it mean for me not only here as Malika, who I am today, but what does it mean for me in the line of my ancestry? Like, what have the people who've come before me been through, felt, experienced, learned, lost? And how do I make my decisions about taking care of who I am today in that light? And in the light of our future generation, the youth who I work with, the young babies, and those who are to come. And those are the questions that I ask myself when I think about what am I doing to take care of myself? Because I don't see myself as an individual. Like, I see myself as connected to something much bigger than just me. I mean, my time on this earth is so, it's so short, and nothing is promised, you know? So I really take every moment as a gift on this spiritual journey. And so those choices, you know, it's like I wrote something, I think, on Facebook that day that was just, or the day before, just really wanting to honor and acknowledge whatever choice people made that day, especially speaking to, you know, brothers and sisters who are identify as coming from communities of color, especially for, you know, my friends who are Black, especially for folks who don't identify in the, you know, gender binary, like really just honoring. I honor you if you decide to go down there. I honor you if you decide not to go down there. And I trust that I might not necessarily be able to understand why, but that that's okay. And, you know, some people might disagree with me about that, but this is just, you know, where I'm at in my journey around thinking about that.
Just play, and I'll see.
We always welcome new collective members. And if you're interested in joining us as a producer, host, or engineer, no experience necessary, please contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator, volunteer@kboo.fm. You can connect with us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can access our podcasts and share feedback or show ideas. Like us on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses, and we're still on Twitter, @BreadRosesRadio. If you're just tuning in, this is Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Pamela Santos, and I've been talking to Malika Balash.
I'm almost for sure about this, and I'm going to check it later, but I'm just going to say, no, I'm going to prove it, that I was right. It was the activist. It is a Pinoy trans amazing, also disability activist, Kay Ulande Barrett, who is very into talking about all the different ways you can support. And I even remember there was, I believe it was a PDF that was circulating about all the ways that you can support, even if you're not on the front lines, like if you are not able-bodied, to go out in the streets for any kind of direct action, if there are other circumstances that prevent you. So all of the different ways, someone's immigration status, someone's family status, someone who cannot afford to be arrested and then possibly not make bail, and who have people depending on them, all of those different ways. And I want to say it numbered about like 26, like all, like so much that you can do to keep supporting a movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are too many ways to do it. And it's, and I'm not even talking money. I'm talking about like cooking for people, making sure, hey, did somebody have a really hard time? There were rubber bullets, there were tear gas. Do people need to arrange body work? Do people need something for even just helping with their mental health? Even like little things that I don't even realize people take for granted is just actually asking somebody how are you in the most genuine, you know, I'm going to accept whatever answer you're going to give me.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that this, I look at it like social media culture right now is really forcing us to talk about everything at every second, at every crossroads. We have to have an eloquent statement about what it is that we experienced. And I've really had to ask myself about that as it relates to like solutions around these big movements that we're a part of. Because I don't really know. We can't know in those moments. Like maybe we think I'm gonna go down, you know, I'm gonna show up. Like I went to the airport, you know, when all that was happening. And I knew my uncle was gonna be there, and I knew a few people in my community were gonna be there, and so I felt good about that. And I knew that I could leave at any time. But you know, I woke up on the day of the Women's March and I knew I can't go down there. Spiritually within myself, it just told me, you know, I don't need to question that. For me, like in that moment, I felt that that wasn't something that I could do to take care of myself that day. And I ended up spending time with a brother who means a lot to me on that day, and we recorded a poem and he played the piano. And why I'm saying this is that I think that there are so many ways that we engage in movements. And I think that we are so focused on solution right now that we're missing some of the deeper paradigm shifts. We're missing the like looking back to move forward. That's why all my work is around my ancestry and understanding where I come from and thinking about what is being authentic and traditional mean to me today? How do I show my values and not say them? And how are those things a part of my solution in this movement? For me, that looks lots of different ways. Some days it looks like hooping with the youth that I hang out with. Some days it looks like, you know, calling a friend to say, hey, how are you? Can I come pick you up? Can we go to the park? You want to sit on the porch? Just no agenda. Just checking in on people. You know, some days it looks like FaceTiming my dad. It's so, I think the sense of urgency is really important. And I think sometimes we miss some of that like deeper spiritual work of like just engaging every day with people we love, taking care of each other, being in community, holding each other. And I don't have any answers, you know. I just know what I'm learning about for my own health, because I do struggle from, you know, some pretty serious mental health conditions. I have to really consider me in the picture, you know. Am I on my list of what I'm doing today, what I'm taking care of today? So if I'm not, I don't know how equipped I am going to be to really show up for other people in my life. And I've shown that to myself when I've done that, and I haven't been in a good place in my heart and in my spirit, you know? And it will come out later, but I really think that this work that we're doing, this movement, especially in agencies, like any type of equity work, it's very spiritual work. It's not something you could slap a statement on, slap a, you know, solution on. It's really deep and spiritual work. And for me, that makes a lot of sense because I was raised in a very spiritual way. And I think sometimes that makes people uncomfortable, and I think that's okay. But for me, that's the standpoint that I come from this at, you know. It's a spiritual movement. And so I respect the different forms that that comes in. And I hope that I continue to be open to growing and learning and doing better as I walk through that. Because I'm not under any, you know, impression that I have everything figured out. I think if I got to that point, I would be, you know, I would be lost. So these are some of the things that I think about when I think about our movements.
I remember my father in the morning. Sunlight sieved through the window screen into the kitchen. He cleaned mint leaves from his jardin. His beige ilaba suede as he passed between cupboards, searching for gunpowder tea and wildflower honey. His toes curled inside his house shoes, my father reached for a silver teapot. He and I carried it across the ocean from the northern Sahara, etched with patterns that mimic the sand. The mint had purple stalks, which he pushed inside the silver on top of the tea, the honey and dried sage, making aromatic his sixth decade leather hands. The kitchen was a holy place. He poured simmering water from the kettle into the silver, and the leaves and honey made whirlpools. The burner on low, the whirlpool bounced for its second slow boil. A thousand times I watched, each the same. The mint, the cupboard, the pot, the pilot. And every morning, as the gunpowder unraveled, my father sat whispering Sir Oz from his red and gold Quran. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. The sunrise streamed through half-opened blinds. My father poured tea, beginning low, raising his arm to make a long stream, and low again. I remember my father in the morning, having tea with Allah.
I'm acknowledging this right now. So I'm acknowledging that I've been very intentional in how I keep bringing up your faith as an identity. And the reason why I'm saying it in this way is because a lot of times I really feel like in discourse, but especially here in Portland, I feel like we've only been talking about Muslim people in a way that is putting them in the narrative as the victim. So you have that recent attack, and people will keep coming back to this, and will come back to in Portland and in Oregon when there are victims of Islamophobic violence. And everything that you're saying is really, for me, in the way that I'm asking you about it, it really resonates for me as a way you're really speaking your own narrative. Like, you are telling me how you are walking through the world as a Muslim American. And at no point do I feel like it is conforming to what we are hearing about the victim narrative.
Right. Yeah. I mean, something I love to share with people when I think about my identity as a Muslim, first is that, like, I don't wear hijab. I don't cover. And so my experience walking through the world is going to be really different than a sister who does. And I think that's really important for me to say, especially on the radio when someone can't see me, if they don't know me or they haven't been in contact with me. And that I recognize that there is nuance in our identity. There is so much nuance. In fact, I think oftentimes the term people of color can serve to erase that nuance within our communities, and especially what does it mean to be a Black Muslim, which I'm not. So these are things that I like to think about when I think about our identity and how we are perceived. And yes, a victimized. But the thing that I love to share is that the city that my dad comes from in northern Morocco, Fez, it's the oldest city in his country. It's in the north, it's in a valley, it rests in a valley, and it's covered by Roman ruins, the surrounded by Roman ruins from the Roman Empire. We've been through so much imperialism, you know, over the years. And in the city where my dad was raised is the oldest university in the entire world. And this university was developed and created by a Muslim woman in the year 859. Her name was Fatima al-Firi. And I think that when I remember that and I think about that every day, I know I come from greatness. And what I wonder is why I'm constantly having to prove that to people, or being asked to prove that to people. So I know that. Fatima is also the name of my grandmother and my father's mother. And I think about that name a lot. There are some powerful people with that name, very powerful. And I mean powerful in like a deep and spiritual way. So I know where I come from, and I'm not very concerned with how other people perceive us or view us. I think that sometimes what happens when your community is under threat is that threat becomes the heart of your identity. So like how I see this in my own work is like when people ask me about what does it mean to be Arab, what does it mean to be Muslim, generally they're thinking about 9/11 as the center of my web. If you think about the web as my world and my life, that 9/11 is at the middle there. For me, no. I think about that University Al-Qarawin. I think about the city that my dad comes from. I think about the mountains, the Atlas Mountains. I think about our ancestors and that homeland. And you blow that web up, and there is a little dot there, 9/11. And there's a little dot, these tragedies. They're all over it. Tragedies have been happening for so long. But these things that have created a victim mentality in this country are one moment in a history that is so much deeper that I think specifically white people don't have a lot of patience to looking into, to understanding. And that makes me feel sad. But I think it's okay because I know where I come from, and I trust that. And you know, I fear only Allah, and so I trust that people are going to learn things in their own time and way. And I don't get to change people, but I do get to influence the people in my life. And that's why who I am is how I am. That's why I share my foods with people. I don't give them the recipes, but I'll share the food with them. I'll make them the tea, but I'm not going to tell them how to make it. And that's not always the best way. You know, I also do policy work, you know, in the agency that I work for. And I'm very invested in that work. So it's not just one thing. You know, the ways that we do this movement work through our identities, where our identities are valued, honored, understood, acknowledged. It looks so many different ways. It looks like that in my food traditions, in my agency work, when I'm hooping, all these different things. It's all there with me because it doesn't leave me. Who I am, my identity doesn't, it's never separate from me. You know, it is me. It is who I am when I walk into a room, you know.
I really wanted to thank you for coming on Bread and Roses. And before we go, I really wanted to give an opportunity for anyone who wants to support your work or see you or in any way find community with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor. It's been an honor to get to be here and to share from my heart and my spirit. And as always, open to thoughts from anyone and questions, etc. The best way to find me is to hit me up on Instagram, MVBELHAJJJ. Find me there, or I will be reading at Unchased, the writing series that Jenny Forrester puts together this July on the 19th. I believe it starts in the evening around 7 p.m., but there will be info on Facebook about that pretty soon, I assume. You know, I work out in East County, and something I see in the city a lot is people talking a lot about community, but I don't see a lot of people east of 82nd or east of 182nd. So if you want to come do some work with some community, you can hit me up on Instagram again, and I will be happy to make connections so you can show up in a good way for the outer parts of our city. So that's probably it, yeah.
And your chapbook.
And my chapbook, Binsiyev, Daughter of Arab America, I'm done printing them. I printed over 200 copies and they're gone. They were at the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn. They've been all over.
Yes, I wanted to ask about that. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was really dope. So I'm working on another piece. It's called Safi, and it's going to be coming out in July, and I'm going to have that at Unchased. It's a short book. It's a pretty intense poem. I'm going to be reading it that night and performing it, and it's a letter to both of my parents. So yeah, that'll be coming out soon. Yeah, I think those are the only things I have to plug now.
And the funny part of it is, see, just tricking you, interview's not over yet. You made a limited run of 200 copies of Binti.
Mm-hmm.
And did you intend on only having these copies and you're not going to make it again, despite if even people, you know, if demand asked for it?
Oh, man. So I originally only made 10 copies of Binti. And then people were like, girl, are you crazy? You need to make more. So I made 100 more copies. And they were gone. Halas. Like, it was so fast. Then I was like, all right, I'll make some more. Because, you know, if those went, maybe some people want some more. And I had a few people ask me. I was going to do an event with YGB. And so I thought, okay, I'll have some there to sell. And I made 100 more. And I mean, you got to think about this. Like, I hand cut all the paper, like literally rip it. It's a very like gentle process. I screen print all the covers. You know, I print all the insides at IPRC and then I sew them together. So it's very labor intensive and it's a labor of love. It's not that I don't want to make more. It's that that period has passed and I'm working on a different piece. And that's where I'm at right now. Maybe I'll make Binti again someday. But for now, it feels like I did enough there. And what I did was more than I could have ever imagined. And the support and the love has been unbelievable. It's a gift.
I really love it because you're still talking about intention and creation and not commercialism.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I want to stay self-published. Like, I would love to have ownership over my work. And I mean that not in the sense of, like it's not about me. Like, I can't tell you the most important thing that happened writing this piece was, like, I sent it to someone, and they hit me up, and they were just like, or someone found it, you know? And that, yeah, she found it. And she said to me, this meant so much to me. I felt this. This is my experience, you know. I have a white mama. I have a Palestinian dad. And she just sent me this long email. And I've never met this person still to this day. And that I've had that experience before with people where I've heard someone talking and I just cried. Oh, wow. My experience is real because I'm hearing somebody else articulate it. So, yeah, it's not about consumerism. I mean, it's about sharing my story in the light of my ancestors and the gift of being able to get to do that and to share it with my students. And, you know, those are just pieces of me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was an honor.
Shukran.
There is a crowdfunder for the two girls who were targeted in the traumatic attack on the Max. That's going toward their mental health treatment and basic living expenses. That link is ucaring.com/survivorsofthemaxattack-833557. Or simply search for it on the internet, Survivors of the Max Attack on UCaring. You've been listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland. Thanks so much for listening. Many thanks to our guest, Malika Balaj. Thanks again to our engineer, Tom Flynn, and our evening public affairs director, Zelos Marchand. Next week is going to be a great show where you can actually call in. It's going to be taking questions, and it's going to be focused on self-care for people of color. Our guest is Anna Vo. And we're really just taking on whatever issues that you really are struggling with. And we're going to try our best to, if not give advice, just really validate and really allow for all of us here at Bread and Roses to hold space for those challenges and that you're not in it alone. So you can do that by calling us live 503-231-8187 when we're in studio next week at 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock. You can contact us on our Facebook or our Twitter pages, or you can simply email us at breadandroses@kboo.fm. So here's a song just to go out on the weekend on a peaceful note by Low Leaf, Cleansing Incantation. Have a great night, everybody.
Transcending time, I've been
The time is 7 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of We Can Listen, The Power of Being Heard. This is a monthly event series at the Old Church in Portland. This month, it takes